It's Wednesday, June 25th, and it's 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org, and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Hey everybody, welcome to your daily audio stash. Glad to have you here. I'm just anticipating the arrival of my parents. Yes, driving across the great expanses of eastern Oregon from Boise, Idaho, all the way here to Portland. We're on our way to the Oregon coast for our biannual family reunion. So I'll have a lot of fun this coming up weekend here. All right, coming up on the stash, we're going to be speaking with Tom Dobert, who's the founder and director of Montana Patients and Families United. He's going to be telling us about medical marijuana and how medical marijuana law allows for the use of medicine by parolees and probationers, some stuff that us reformers ought to get into some of those other medical marijuana laws. Also, as usual on Wednesday, we'll be talking about cannabis science with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, Associate Professor of Psychology at the State University of New York at Albany. And this time, Dr. Earlywine and I take a look at the new report from the Center on Substance Abuse, Joseph Califano's group there, talking about marijuana's potency and how it's driving the kids insane. We've also got our musical break, another song from my homie over in Bend, Oregon, The Dirtball. This song is a great little tune called Moonshine Rhyme. And also, if you're competing in our Pass the Stash contest that we announced on Monday, nobody has won yet. Gotta look at those questions real close, people. The first email I get at stash@normal.org that has all three correct answers, you're the winner of Pot Culture by Steve Bloom and Shirley Halperin. So check out the blog at stash.normal.org. I've posted a couple of hints and all three questions so that you can try to win that stash. All right, everybody, sit back and relax, grab yourself some Purple Kush, and enjoy your Normal Daily Audio Stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our Normal Daily Audio Stash, Hemp Headlines. Drug use cost New Zealand society $1.3 billion, from the New Zealand Herald. The Drug Harm Index, released yesterday, will help police determine the socioeconomic costs from drug seizures and track the value of the drug trade in New Zealand. It found that 373,310 people used cannabis, but only 17% of these were frequent users. There were 38,390 cocaine users, of which 88% were frequent users. Nearly 23,000 people used crystal meth, 36% of them often, and 81,890 took ecstasy, 24% of them often. So, 83% of the New Zealanders who use cannabis use it infrequently and responsibly, and the 63,462 who use cannabis often are almost as numerous as those who use coke, meth, and ecstasy, 61,717 of them. Plus, we can't say how many of the frequent users use more than one drug. Male cannabis users took about 8% more sick days than the average male worker and opioid users took 40% more days. I'm curious about how many more sick days were taken by alcohol users. Well, no matter. I can't speak for New Zealand, but in America, the average number of paid sick leave days for first-year employees is 8. So, if cannabis smokers took 8% more, that works out to about an extra 5 hours off for sick leave. But I also doubt the reality of those numbers. How do male cannabis users track across various fields of endeavor? For example, you're going to find more cannabis smokers working in a restaurant than in a boardroom. And drug testing restricts the fields where cannabis smokers can work. Are there more overall sick days taken in those fields than others? While stimulants contributed 41% of the total costs, figures showed that in 2006, police and customs seized 33,480 kilograms of cannabis, compared with only 155 kilograms of stimulants. And police dealing with drug offenses spent 55.8% of their time addressing cannabis against 43% of their hours dealing with stimulant-related issues. Sounds like a lot of time and effort spent by the New Zealand authorities to fight cannabis, a relatively safe, socially benign drug that 83% of its users are using infrequently, to the detriment of fighting meth, a very dangerous, socially devastating drug that 36% of its users are abusing. Kind of like here in America, huh? Hawaii governor may veto medical marijuana task force bill. From the Honolulu Advertiser. Hawaii Governor Linda Lingle may veto a bill that would set up a task force to study issues surrounding medical marijuana because it could potentially counter federal prohibitions against the drug. Governor Lingle said in a statement, quote, "The legislature and many individuals in the community worked hard to pass these measures. However, it is my responsibility as governor to ensure that the bills are legal, constitutional, fiscally sound, and in the best long-term interest of the public," end quote. Maybe I don't understand Hawaii's state government, but don't the courts have the responsibility of determining whether bills are legal and constitutional? You can contact the governor and tell her that this bill merely directs the state to study the feasibility of medical marijuana distribution and to review possession limits for patients. Nothing against federal law can be found in that bill. Contact the Honorable Linda Lingle, the governor of the state of Hawaii, the Executive Chambers, State Capitol, Honolulu, Hawaii, 96813. You can phone 808-586-0034, and the fax number is 808-586-0006, or email governor.lingle, L-I-N-G-L-E, governor.lingle at hawaii.gov. North Carolina House to hear from marijuana advocates. From BlueRidgeNow.com. Advocates and local residents will speak before the State House this week to encourage a study into the use of medicinal marijuana. Polk County resident Gene Marlowe, Democratic Representative Earl Jones of Guilford County, former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Joycelyn Elders, and Saluda resident Ray Pegg plan to speak Wednesday at the Capitol Auditorium. Jones said he will introduce a measure calling for a study to be done on the benefits of medicinal marijuana. Jones said, quote, "Dr. Elders will address the Science and Technology Committee of the House about this subject. I have a bill that will be requesting a study committee," end quote. Jones said he is introducing the bill because he believes marijuana may hold a potential cure for ailments or pain. Jones said, quote, "Marijuana has been proven in studies to reduce the pain and suffering in patients suffering from Alzheimer's disease, glaucoma, multiple sclerosis, AIDS, and cancer," end quote. Jones said his top priority in policymaking is to benefit the public, and in this case, helping the public manage pain. He said, quote, "There is not a reason for marijuana not to be used legally in North Carolina if it could help our residents manage their pain and suffering," end quote. Just a reminder, we interviewed Representative Jones on the Daily Audio Stash back on June 2nd. You can hear that interview if you just go back to the archives, and I've got a link to that up on our blog at stash.normal.org. Marijuana may be good for neuropathic pain. From NewsWise. The growing body of evidence that marijuana may be effective as a pain reliever has been expanded with publication of a new study in the Journal of Pain, reporting that patients with nerve pain showed reduced pain intensity from smoking marijuana. Researchers at University of California, Davis examined whether marijuana produces analgesia for patients with neuropathic pain. 38 patients were examined. They were either given high dose, 7% THC, low dose, 3.5% THC, or placebo cannabis. The authors reported that identical levels of analgesia were produced at each cumulative dose level by both concentrations of the agent. As with opioids, cannabis does not rely on a relaxing or tranquilizing effect, but reduces the core component of nociception and the emotional aspect of the pain experience to an equal degree. There were undesirable consequences observed from cannabis smoking, such as feeling high or impaired, but they did not inhibit tolerability or cause anyone to withdraw from the study. In general, side effects and mood changes were inconsequential. It was noted by the authors that since high and low dose cannabis produced equal analgesic efficacy, a case could be made for testing lower concentrations to determine if the analgesic profile can be maintained while reducing potential cognitive decline. In addition, the authors said further research could probe whether adding the lowest effective doses of cannabis to another analgesic drug might lead to more effective neuropathic pain treatment for patients who otherwise are treatment resistant. Funny thing, this study has been out since April, and we reported on it back then, and yet it was never seen in the mainstream media. But when a study arises showing marijuana is ineffective for acute pain treatment, it gets picked up the very next day by the Washington Post. Just another way in which prohibitionist politics affects the reporting of marijuana science. The good reports get buried, and the bad reports get headlines.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
We're going up now to the great state of Montana, which of course is one of the 12 medical marijuana states in the United States, and a lot of people don't know this, but holds the record for the largest amount of support from the voters. They voted in with 62% of the vote, and they have about 700 patients now in their program. We're going to speak now with the founder and director of Montana Patients and Families United, Tom Dobert. And Tom, welcome to the Daily Audio Stash.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Hey, great to have you. And, you know, funny thing, I just got back from Montana a couple, 3-4 weeks ago. I was in the Helena area, and it's always so beautiful every time I go there. And it's a really great state as far as cannabis politics goes. It seems like you have a lot of support for your medical marijuana program.
Well, we do. And as you noted, we do still hold the record for the largest margin of public support, more votes than President Bush or our governor or any of the statewide candidates got in that election year. So something to be very proud of. And as you said, a lot of public support, not universal. And, you know, there are continuing problems for patients, as there are everywhere. But
Yeah, until we can end the prohibition of marijuana, I think there's always going to be that problem between the law enforcement and the medical aspects of it.
Definitely. I think the federal government's continuing anti-scientific-based policy is the biggest problem patients face, and it obstructs physicians unfairly and invalidly, too, from being willing to participate. There's still an awful lot of fear surrounding the whole thing, thanks to the drug war's rhetoric and craziness.
Now, one of the issues that crops up here in this nexus between law enforcement and medical use would have to do with people who are caught up in the criminal justice system. Now, since medical marijuana is not recognized by the feds, there's not a lot of chance of people being able to use it while they're incarcerated. But then there's also the case of people who are either on probation or parole. And the Montana law has some interesting things that kind of protect the patients in this aspect. And I thought it might be nice if you could tell folks just a little bit about that situation.
Well, at least so far, at the moment, patients are receiving some protection. I think because of some of the themes we were talking about before, just the drug war overall and the tendency of people involved in law enforcement, including probation officers, to automatically regard marijuana as an illegal drug no matter what, and to incorrectly think that it's addicting. There were problems from the get-go here for those very few legitimate patients who happened to be on parole and probation. And the corrections department here was imposing a requirement that they not use medical marijuana, was trying to deny medical marijuana to anyone on probation and parole, actually proposed a formal rule to put that policy in concrete, even as it was already trying to impose that rule. And our group fought back on behalf of the legitimate rights of those few patients and the fact that our law is very clear. And ultimately, we won. I think we that makes us, as far as I know, the first of the medical marijuana states to have a flat, automatic right for anyone who happens to be on probation and parole to be a medical marijuana patient as long as they meet the other requirements under our law. Our law says that no one who is a registered patient with the health department, which requires a doctor's recommendation and that you have a qualifying condition under the law, the law says no one in that circumstance can be penalized or punished in any way. Mm. And our law also does specify that you can't use medical marijuana while in a corrections facility. And we were able to successfully point out to the department that people who are on probation or parole are not in a corrections facility and therefore should receive all the protections under the law. And as I said, ultimately, it was a bit of a struggle, but ultimately, the Department of Corrections agreed.
I think that's something that reformers should look to as well when we're trying to amend the laws that already exist or pass new laws, say in New York and all these other New Jersey and states that are looking at medical marijuana, is that there needs to be something that spells out that the patients cannot be punished for their use of medical marijuana. I'm here in Oregon, and we've seen all sorts of assaults coming from our legislature on trying to take people's driver's license, restrict them from certain jobs, lose their housing, and so on. So I'm really glad to see that in your law. I also had something else I always wonder when I hear this about not allowing probationers or parolees to use medical marijuana. They're still allowed to use any other prescribed Schedule 2 or 3 substance, aren't they?
Definitely. I mean, there's never been an issue with respect to any other aspect of a person's medical treatment or prescription drugs, only medical marijuana. And that was something we pointed out, too, that the Department of Corrections doesn't have the authority under the law, nor does it have the training and expertise to unilaterally overrule a doctor's judgment on any issue. Including medical marijuana.
Right. That would like malpractice, exactly.
Well, yeah, actually what we said was it's not only practicing medicine without a license, it's malpracticing medicine.
Yeah. Exactly.
And we also argued that if they were to do that, they would have to assume all responsibility for all aspects of the person's medical care. You can't make one change in the way a person's being treated without having to completely reevaluate what the person needs. And we argued that they would bear all the responsibility at that point.
Mm. And of course, this isn't just us talking conceptually here. This affects real people. And you had a case you were discussing on one of the lists where we share emails and such. Tell them about the case of Tim and his problems there, and how that got wrapped up into this situation.
Well, it's a very similar situation, but distinct. Tim Nelson is a medical marijuana patient in Montana who was arrested years ago before he was able to become registered as a patient. He met all the criteria but hadn't registered at the time of his arrest. And to make a very long story short, he was registered by the time of his trial, but the judge ordered him. He was sentenced to 3 years of probation, and the judge ordered him to use Marinol, not medical marijuana, for those 3 years of probation. And Tim is appealing that sentence to the state Supreme Court, and our group united with the Montana affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union to file an amicus brief in that case, making a number of arguments. One of which is that, similar to what we were just talking about in the situation with probation officers, that a judge doesn't have the authority to practice medicine from the bench, and to functionally prescribe Marinol is inappropriate on that level alone. In addition, Tim's medical need for marijuana pertains to pain relief, which is not one of the uses for which Marinol has FDA approval. Beyond that, the cost of Marinol would actually exceed Tim's entire monthly income. He's a 100% disabled, has very small income, and couldn't afford the Marinol even if it would help him. So he's appealing that to the state Supreme Court. And we're arguing that under Montana's constitution, which is actually somewhat more protective of the right to privacy and of certain other rights than the U.S. Constitution, we're arguing that just as the court here has already decided in different situations that everyone has the right to the health care of his or her choice, we're arguing that people have the right to actually follow the medical care advice that they've received. And that case is pending. We have no idea when a decision might be issued.
Well, that's great to hear, though. And we hear that from a lot of the states that we talk to here on the stash. And, of course, Alaska's constitution has its privacy rights that give the people the right to grow and possess cannabis in their own homes. And so I'd encourage everyone to take a look at your, you know, state constitutions and see what your privacy rights exactly are in that state. Now, Tom Dober is the founder and director of Montana Patients and Families United. You can catch up with them at mtpfu.org. MT like Montana, PFU like Patients Families United.org. And we'll have a link to that up at our blog at stash.normal.org. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us here on the Stash.
You're welcome. Great to join you. Thanks.
Now it's time to play Pass the Stash, where you can win cool prizes from Normal.
All right, folks, time for our June Pass the Stash contest. Yeah, with only 1 week left to go, I know. I got a little busy. The prize this month is a copy of Steve Bloom's new book, Pot Culture, The A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life. And all you have to do to win is pass our special drug test. Now, don't worry, we don't want your pee. We just want your correct answer on the following three multiple choice questions. Question number one. Which of the following four stoner movies made the most money at the box office? Was it A, Half-Baked with Dave Chappelle? B, The Big Lebowski with Jeff Bridges as the dude? C, Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, the first Harold and Kumar movie? Or D, Tenacious D and the Pick of Destiny with Jack Black? Question number two. How many people were arrested for simple marijuana possession in 2006? Is it A, about 1.9 million, B, B, about 830,000, C, about 740,000, or D, about 610,000? And question number three, according to the Institutes of Medicine, what percentage of cannabis users eventually become clinically dependent on cannabis? Is it A, about 31%, B, about 15%, C, about 9%, or D, it's a trick question because nobody becomes clinically dependent on marijuana? Send your answers along with your name to our email at stash@normal.org. You can remain anonymous if you wish, just say so. The first email to hit my inbox with all three correct answers wins the Pot Culture book. Remember, the three questions are, which of the following four stoner movies made the most money at the box office? How many people were arrested for simple marijuana possession in 2006? And according to the Institutes of Medicine, what percentage of cannabis users eventually become clinically dependent on cannabis? Check out our blog at stash.normal.org. You can see all the questions and the possible answers right there in the blog. And again, first email to make it to my inbox with all three correct answers wins the Pot Culture book. Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. My homie the Dirtball is back with another slamming track from his CD, Crook County. Because my other homie, Cannabis Carrie, is up to her elbows in making tie-dyes for the upcoming summer festival season. You can check out her work at planetfantastic.blogspot.com. The Dirtball raps on Suburban Noise Records, and I love how he incorporates fresh new sounds into his beats. You'll hear instruments and genres in his music that reflect the wide-open spaces of Central Oregon, along with his lyrical flow that fits perfectly into any urban setting. This song is called Moonshine Rhyme, and you can get more information about it by visiting our blog at stash.normal.org, where you can also get a download of this song. It's The Dirtball with Moonshine Rhyme.
This is my moonshine rhyme. You know I'm staying drunk most all of the time. I say goodbye to the world, then I go so again. Get back, relax, drink it with my friends. This is my moonshine rhyme. You know I'm staying drunk most all of the time. I say goodbye to the world, then I go so again. Get back, relax, drink it with my friends.
Hey, here's a seat, sit down and have a drink. Vibe with me for a moment, taste and tell me what you think. I love liquor, love beer, wine gets me almost there. But the shine from the moon makes the rainy sky clear. No matter what, she get me through the dark times. Only damn problem is that I do love her too much. Can't put her down, always there for me in the clutch. Ain't the bong about to keep her strong, I know that I must. She the goods, made the perfection, the perfect selection. Crafted by my hand and you will see no protesting. Cause all my neighbors know I make a mean batch. They swill it down the hatch and I politely say,
friends and family take a shot with me. Toast to good times, thank God with me. Pouring out for those that passed away. Have a couple more, we're getting drunk today. This is my moonshine rhyme. You know I'm staying drunk most all of the time. I say goodbye to the world, then I go so again. Kick back, relax, drink it with my friends. This is my moonshine rhyme. You know I'm staying drunk most all of the time. I say goodbye to the world, then I go so again. Kick back, relax, drink it with my friends. Yeah.
Every day's a Friday, the Saturday's a my day. To make the magic potion, really stock my supply. What would I lie? I speak at my speakeasy, but you can't order what the other saloons provide. It don't compare to what I'm cracking off out my still. Ain't no pill, try to fail, copy the high. This is the real deal, be no faking. Surrounded by the souls of the desert where I forever reside. We never die, we staying pickled through the pores. Fully functioning, sharing all the good times of yours. Don't we telling at the burn side, tall tales sipping, we ain't tripping. Ha ha.
This is my moonshine rhyme, you know I'm staying drunk. All of the time I say goodbye to the world, then I go so again. Kick back, relax, drink it with my friends. This is
say no.
No matter what you call it, it's a huge part of popular culture.
Where'd you learn that, Cheech? Drug school.
You don't need weed school. You just need a copy of the new book, Pot Culture, The A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life.
Hey, this is great, man.
Even if you never smoked marijuana.
I never used marijuana. Sorry.
Don't think you smoked marijuana.
I experimented with marijuana a time or two and didn't inhale.
Or you used to smoke marijuana.
I inhaled frequently. That was the point.
Pot Culture by former High Times editor Steve Bloom and Shirley Halperin will answer every question you ever had about marijuana culture.
Has that marijuana made it back up here yet?
Check out Pot Culture, the A to Z Guide to Stoner Language and Life at Amazon.com or visit PotCultureBook.com today.
Too bad, man. I just stopped smoking yesterday.
Time for a little bit more cannabis science, and joined on Wednesday, as we always are, by Dr. Mitch Earlywine, Associate Professor of Psychology at the State University of New York in Albany, and probably one of the nation's foremost researchers on cannabis. So, Dr. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Great to be back.
Hey, I saw that your job was in danger. was it a police officer or somebody that got a little upset about you speaking out on cannabis?
This is interesting because I, of course, over the years, I always get emails sent to me saying, oh, you're wrong and you're Satan and you're killing our children and stuff like that. And I'm always happy to engage with folks who aren't on the same side as me on the cannabis debate. But this was somebody who actually emailed the president of the university.
No.
Of course, I didn't appreciate it all. And I just wanted to say, you know, if you've got a bone to pick with me, by all means, pick it with me. But also that the university has been incredibly supportive. I am really grateful to SUNY Albany and our provost for both responding to this person who sent an email to the president and really supporting me and being able to, you know, enjoy academic freedom, go out there and speak the truth and not have to be subject to some kind of concerns about my own job security. So big thumbs up for SUNY.
Yeah, good for them. And, you know, this always bothers me when it comes to this debate on the war on drugs, more so than it seems like almost any other subject, that people aren't even willing to debate it. As soon as you bring up a contrary point of view, they just want to shut you down. And maybe that's because their argument is on such shoddy footing.
I find that they're often the ones who quickly run to these moral, oh, it's intuitively obvious that this is just evil kind of arguments. And so then any presentation of data doesn't reach them. But as I've pointed out before, Doug Cusack talks about the morals behind drug prohibition and just says, you know, we're living in a country where we like to see the punishment fit the severity of the crime, meaning if a crime causes other people a lot of harm, by all means, the punishment should be severe. But what, in truth, is the harm anyone is causing somebody else by owning a plant? Obviously nothing. So what should our penalty be?
Exactly. Now, getting to the cannabis science here, there's a new report out from CASA, which is the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse, Joe Califano's group. And I love the title of this one, Non-Medical Marijuana 3, Rite of Passage or Russian Roulette? Ooh, boy, that's scary. But there's all sorts of interesting stats in here. He points out from 92 to 2006, there was a 175% jump in potency from 3.2 to 8.8% THC, a 492% increase in the teen treatment admissions for marijuana, 188% increase in teen treatment for drug of abuse. I mean, this is, once again, we've got this whole potency argument coming out and the teen treatment argument coming out. Let's shoot this down with some real science.
Sure thing. I mean, I went to Columbia. CASA is there. I feel like they do some neat things. They had a day where they said, okay, everybody should have dinner with the family. Of course, a big fan of those kinds of things. But these reports really hurt their credibility, and in fact can hurt some of our credibility with teens. As you know, I've got a book out, The Parent's Guide to Marijuana, and I'm really into making sure that folks don't use marijuana too early in life in order to avoid negative consequences. However, jumping up and down about increases in potency is not the way to make this happen. I'm afraid that, in fact, these, oh, it's all new potent and really scary messages are actually encouraging folks through that forbidden fruit kind of effects we've talked about before. Now, anytime you see anybody taking a percentage of a percentage, I feel like we got to start getting suspicious. So, yes, cannabis used to be 3.2% THC on average, and now it's 8.8% on average. But this is all based on seized samples. It's really all about who happened to get busted and whose pot ended up going down to Mississippi to get evaluated. And in truth, if they had wanted to examine, you know, more of different set of samples, we have no idea really what on average is the percent THC. But the tacit assumption, again, is that this is somehow more dangerous. And in fact, we do have laboratory data showing that people inhale less when they're using stronger cannabis, and that there's an opportunity for fewer respiratory problems as a result of smaller inhalations. And, you know, as we've talked about time and again, if folks are vaporizing, this shouldn't be an issue anyway. But the other thing that just kind of makes me laugh is the consistent message Joe Califano is saying, today's pernicious pot is not your parents' pot. Well, if you're, you know, 17 years old and you hear, hey, today's pot is not your parents' pot, what do you think? Good. I don't want my parents' pot. You know? And in fact, that's kind of a steal from some of the old car ads. They're like, hey, this is not your dad's car. Like, your dad's car was some old fogey's car, and this is a really cool car. And now we're essentially saying, hey, your dad's pot was some old fogey pot, and we've got the good pot now. And so I'm really apprehensive about this approach. Now, these treatment admissions I've also talked about before, this is really suspicious to me. Okay, yes, more teens are going into treatment for cannabis-related problems, or so they say, but in fact, a lot of this is because they get in trouble for a possession bust and get the opportunity to either, you know, do some time or go to a treatment program, and what a surprise, they pick going to the treatment program. Incidentally, the diagnosis of cannabis abuse has one symptom that is trouble with the law. So here you pass a law that makes this possession illegal, then you bust people for it, you make that bust a category for getting this diagnosis, and then you say, gee, this diagnosis is up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just such a wild house of cards that I feel like interpreting these stats has become this kind of smoke and mirrors exercise instead of where we ought to focus, which is, look, we've seen teens show decreases in IQ if they start heavy use of marijuana early in life. We've seen teens show altered brain structure if they start marijuana use early in life. These are true data-supported assertions. Let's focus on these. And then let's ask teens themselves, what are the things that are important to them? This idea that this is either a rite of passage, meaning every teen has to do it, or Russian roulette, you're holding a gun to your head with a bullet in it, is just too dichotomous and really not getting the point across in a way that I think is going to make for efficient substance abuse prevention.
And I think we've shown here in a tax and regulated market where we use education to get to kids that we can have an effect on their use, and that market would be tobacco. You know,
an ideal comparison. And in fact, when you look at perceptions of risk on tobacco and use, we're seeing tobacco use down. I mean, why does everybody have to stand outside their building in the cold in order to smoke a cigarette now? It's because people have said, oh, this is really dangerous. We want to change this. And I think that that's an intriguing way to go about this with marijuana as well. And unfortunately, when you look at the data, in fact, you realize marijuana probably isn't as dangerous as tobacco as far as a lot of health consequences are concerned. And so then that kind of undermines our whole prohibition anyway.
Yeah, and the idea of, you know, sentencing people to treatment, I can't imagine that there's a lot of drug treatment counselors out there who are, you know, dealing with some really serious hard cases of abuse that they really want their space utilized by people who don't belong there. I can't imagine that's something that the professional community is in favor of. Are they?
Folks who don't belong there or folks who are there as part of their sentence are really, really tough on burnout. And substance abuse treatment providers burn out really easily. If you last 5 years in this field, it's really to your credit. And I bow down to these guys who are spending 40 hours a week sitting across from folks who are, you know, at risk for relapse all the time. And it's really, really difficult, draining work. But then you get somebody in there who's clearly in there only because the judge basically said, you've got to go, and, you know, they're hanging their head, they're bored out of their minds, and you're really burning clinical time that you could be devoting to somebody else. It's really a tough situation. Every once in a while, you say the thing or something happens, and you do get the chance to turn them around, and I want to definitely praise these programs that turn folks to treatment rather than prison, But again, we shouldn't essentially throw teens into prison or treatment based on a single possession charge. It just doesn't seem to fit the best use of our resources as far as treatment is concerned.
Yeah, and it goes back to that idea of use versus abuse, and they see that all use is some sort of abuse that needs treatment. And I always counter that by saying, you know, what if we had sentenced to treatment everybody who ever got a hangover? We'd see, you know, a huge increase in alcohol treatment, but that wouldn't mean we have a whole bunch more alcoholics necessarily.
Very, very much so. That's absolutely the case.
Now, in these stats that the CASA report comes across here, you know, they're doing the potency thing here again, and, you know, we've debunked this a number of times, but I think one of the things I like to point out in this is the incredibly wide range of variants that they find in the potency. You know, they have some of these samples that go down into the industrial hemp range of, you know, sub 1% THC, all the way up to these, you know, high varieties that are up into the 20s and 30s in THC, you know, this huge range of variants. And I think that would also speak to, you know, what are the kids really getting a hold of? Are they really getting a hold of this connoisseur marijuana? Is that more likely to be medical marijuana that they wouldn't have access to? Is there any way of telling exactly what the kids are getting a hold of?
It's funny because before he died, John Morgan actually had proposed an idea that we could get folks to send in samples and actually try to compare subjective effects across different dosages. But the bottom line is we just don't know. Odds are high the high THC cannabis is way more expensive than anything most teens could afford. But again, the subjective effects don't seem to increase linearly. So a 9% THC cannabis doesn't get you three times higher than a 3% THC cannabis. And some recent work from Don Abrams' lab shows even with the vaporizer, as you crank up the THC level, that doesn't necessarily mean people are going to get higher and higher or something along those lines. So I feel like in some ways the THC percentage can be a little bit of a red herring. In my lab, some of my students and I have been sitting down and comparing arrest records and THC amounts. And it actually looks like the arrests are driving the THC. So the more arrests, then the following year, the THC seems to go up yet again.
Hmm.
And I'm concerned about this, as you've talked about before, how in alcohol prohibition, we moved from folks having a beer once in a while to suddenly everybody's got an illicit market and they need to get as much alcohol in as small a space as possible, and suddenly everybody's drinking whiskey. I feel like, again, these increases in arrests may be driving this stronger THC. Not that the stronger THC is some kind of scary thing to be frightened of, but it's really in some ways an index of how prohibition has altered the way folks are forced to grow and distribute the cannabis.
Well, we could probably go off on this potency and these false statistics here for quite a bit longer, but we've kind of run out of time here. Before we go, Dr. Earlywine, you know, these fears are stoked from a very legitimate fear, and that is, you know, parents that are worried about their kids getting involved with marijuana. Give us some words of advice. How could parents, you know, just real basically lead their kids away from marijuana without having to resort to these stupid scare tactics?
I feel like I detail this in the parent's guide, but the bottom line is sitting down and having a candid conversation about what are the pros and cons of early use. And in fact, we do see that using early in life isn't adaptive in the long run. You increase your probability of dependence. There's evidence of changes in IQ and changes in brain structure. And then letting your kids do most of the talking. So you let them talk about what's going on, and you say uh-huh and yes, and let them really get this as part of just, you know, your general relationship, and it'll be intriguing to see what you learn from them. And then, instead of doing it, you know, in one single tirade, talking about it a little bit, and then bringing it up again later, so it may not be a one-time sit-down, hour-long conversation so much as an ongoing back and forth about drugs, intoxicants, health, general health, education, and everything. And that this is really just one aspect of your own multifaceted relationship with your kids.
Well, I highly recommend that people get a copy of Parent's Guide to Marijuana. We'll have a link to that up on our blog at stash.normal.org. And, wow, what do you know? If you talk to your kids, good things might happen. Well, Dr. Lewine, thanks for joining us here on the Daily Audio Stash.
Oh, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis.
We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another cannabis quote, this one from Melissa Etheridge, the musician who fought a very high-profile battle with cancer, who said, quote, "Instead of taking 5 or 6 of the prescriptions, I decided to go a natural route and smoke marijuana. Every single doctor said, oh yeah, that's the best help for chemotherapy," end quote. Lucky for Melissa Etheridge, she was able to become a medical marijuana patient in the state of California. So many people are not lucky enough to live in one of the 12 medical marijuana states. 2/3 of the people who could be helped by medical marijuana do not have access to it because of their state laws. Do what you can to change your state laws or support the ones that already exist in your state. Remember, they're always going to be trying to take those rights away from us. Just because you have a medical marijuana law doesn't mean you get to stop fighting for it. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us here for the Daily Audio Stash. I'm heading off to the coast, and until next time, take care of each other, tokers.